Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Roughly 2 years ago, the U.S. Congress passed a major piece of legislation known as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, often referred to as Obamacare. The Speaker of the House at that time, Nancy Pelosi, famously said of the extraordinarily lengthy piece of legislation, quote, "We have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it," unquote. And over the course of those 2 years, different people have been discovering different things that they like or dislike about the Affordable Care Act. This includes the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, who view portions of this legislation and its regulatory implementation as a threat to religious liberty. Through the Ad Hoc Committee on Religious Liberty, headed up by Archbishop William E. Laurie of Baltimore, the Catholic Bishops' Conference recently published a document entitled, Our First Most Cherished Liberty, wherein they criticized the Health and Human Services mandate for contraception, sterilization, and abortion-inducing drugs as a violation of an individual's right to religious conscience. I should note that it is the Department of Health and Human Services that is largely responsible for implementing the Affordable Care Act, and they have subsequently released more pages of regulations that specifically detail how the act will be implemented. With Obamacare currently under review in the U.S. Supreme Court, now seems as good of a time as any to explore whether or not, and how, this law inhibits the First Amendment's guarantee of religious practice. To help me with that endeavor, I am pleased to be joined today by Professor Vincent Philip Munoz, the Tocqueville Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame. Philip is also an associate professor at the University of Notre Dame School of Law and author of God and the Founders, Madison, Washington, and Jefferson. Professor Munoz recently published an article in the Weekly Standard where he examines the U.S. Catholic Bishop's recent statement on religious liberty and the health care mandate. We will be sure to link to that article, his book, as well as the bishop's statements on our website. So if you're interested in following up on this topic after our interview, please use our references to start your own exploration. And if you have any comments on today's podcast, feel free to post them there as well. But please keep it civil, as we are a family-friendly podcast. Philip, thanks for joining us on Research on Religion.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Hey, I got a question to start everything off here that's not related to bishops, it's not related to healthcare mandates, but one that always fascinates me. I have this weird fascination with how people use their names. Now, your name technically is Vincent Philip Munoz, but you use your middle name, Philip, instead of your first name, Vincent. What's the deal
there?
That's
right, yeah. Well, you know, it's a funny story, actually. I can't claim to remember this story, but what I'm told is my father's name is Vicente. Mm-hmm. And right after I was born, I have a brother, older brother, who's 7 years older than me, and got quite frustrated with my mother because he didn't know if my mother was referring to me or my father.
Yeah.
And as only a seven-year-old can do, he protested, had a tantrum, and said, from now on, I'm going to call him Philip. And from that tantrum by my older brother, who's now approaching 50, when he was 7 years old, I go by my middle name, Philip.
Oh, well, so this had nothing to do with your choice. It was just some
not at all.
It's
no.
Kind of interesting.
No freedom of conscience here, no.
Okay, all right. Okay, so let's go ahead and let's talk about the Catholic Bishops' Conference's recent statement. It really seems to have stirred up a bee's nest of controversy. They use some pretty strong language in terms of criticizing the recent healthcare mandate. Tell us a little bit about how this controversy got started and what's it all about.
Yeah, sure. Well, let me make one clarification here, because in talking about this issue, I realize that people get easily confused. When the bishops in their recent statement are talking about the mandate, they mean the contraception mandate, or what's been known as the contraception mandate, not the individual mandate. Now, at the Supreme Court, there's under the Commerce Clause, they're hearing about the individual mandate. That is, you can individually be forced to have health insurance and compelled to buy health insurance. That's not exactly what we're talking about here. That's not really what we're talking about at all. The bishops are opposing one provision of what's known as Obamacare, and that is a provision that requires employers of a certain size, over 50 employees, to provide free of charge to their employees contraception and sterilization coverage. That's what the bishops are unhappy about.
Now, I can imagine that that provision, which might have been implemented by the Health and Human Services Department after the passage of the legislation, if I'm correct.
That's correct.
The provision that says over 50 employees is going to hit the Catholic Church fairly hard because of the way it's organized. You know, you say, well, a parish has a few people working in it, but it's, you know, part of a bigger organization, a diocese, that is going to have 50 people working.
And, you know, Catholic universities or other religiously affiliated universities, hospitals, all sorts of institutions, you know, business owners that have more than 50 employees. I mean, this will affect all sorts of institutions and all sorts of private companies.
Yeah, one can see that now. How long has this issue been festering? Is this something that just popped up in the last few months, or was this something that the bishops were concerned from the get-go, maybe when this bill was being debated in 2009 and 2010?
Yeah, no. The bishops wrote a letter back in September 2010, not 2011, so over a year and a half ago, saying, look, you can't require religious institutions, and they had, you know, they're particularly concerned with Catholic institutions, but I think they meant any institutions to provide these morally objectionable services. And so this was way back in the beginning when the HHS, after Obamacare was passed, and HHS was trying to figure out what was in the law, as Nancy Pelosi said. The Conference of Catholic Bishops sent a letter saying, hey, this will be an issue for you if you require contraception coverage. There's a letter dated, I think it's September 17, 2010. So on the one hand, this issue has just exploded in the last few months, but anyone who was paying attention knew it was going to come about if the Obama administration pressed the contraception mandate.
So they were giving warning bells a year and a half ago, as you said, and nonetheless, the administration just went ahead and said, we're going to go ahead and do this. I got a question about the U.S. Bishops Conference. It tends to speak as a unified voice, but I think we know from history that there are a number of bishops that might be dissenting from some of this. Has the Catholic Bishops Conference here in the United States been completely on board on this, or has there been some dissent, or are there other voices speaking from the Catholic Church about this as well?
Well, let me say at the outfront, I know more about American politics than Catholic politics, so I'm probably not the best person to answer that question. But, I mean, this is a committee that the bishops set up to speak for the bishops as a whole. And as far as I know, the bishops have been in general agreement. Now, I'm certainly, you know, each bishop is the leader of the church in his particular diocese. So bishops certainly can disagree on prudential matters and certainly do disagree. But as far as I know, most of the bishops have been on board with what the Bishops' Conference has been saying on this issue.
Just a factual question. I don't know if you know this or not. You say you're not that informed about bishops' politics, but roughly how many bishops are there in the United States?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I don't know off the top of my head. Yeah. I'm sure we could easily find out with a quick Google search, but I just don't know.
Because I'm wondering just again to see to what extent this is a unified voice that we're saying, or if the committee, and I believe looking at the letter that they recently published, looking at the number of people, the signatories on that, it looked like there was about a dozen people on this ad hoc committee. So
that's right. But the committee, so let me stress that the committee was formed by the bishops to speak for the bishops.
Got it.
So I think there is, at least on the recent statement and on this issue, much agreement among the bishops.
Okay. Yeah, that helps clarify things because I am not by any means expert on internal Catholic politics either. Hey, I want to go ahead and now deconstruct the argument about how this healthcare mandate, or at least the mandate on this specific provision, relates to religious liberty. And I'm going to take a little bit of a step back here and get to the issue of religious liberty itself and how the Catholic Church is conceptualizing it, how Catholic thinkers think about it. What does it mean to possess a right to religious liberty, according to the bishops or other Catholic thinkers?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. The best statement from the Catholic perspective on religious liberty is a document that was part of Vatican II called Dignitatis Humanae. It's the Catholic statement of religious freedom. And that statement, I might add, it's not exactly the same argument that James Madison made, but it's very similar to Madison's argument. One of the most interesting things about the 20th century for a political theorist like myself who's interested in religious liberty is the convergence between the American argument for religious liberty and the Catholic argument for religious liberty. And both Madison, on the one hand, back in the 1780s, and the bishops in the 1960s, and the Catholic Church in the 1960s said, look, mankind is born free and is meant to worship God freely, and therefore ought not be coerced in their religious convictions. And we're talking about coercion by the state, meaning everyone must, to put it in more Catholic terms, Christian terms, everyone must love God freely. That's what God created us for. That's how God created our nature. And therefore, it is wrong for the state to force us, for example, to go to church, or force someone to take the sacraments, or prohibit someone from taking the sacraments. Our very human nature as free beings demands that we be allowed to worship freely. It demands that we have a natural right to religious freedom. So we're primarily talking about state coercion here. The state shouldn't use the law to force a religion on someone or prohibit someone from practicing their religion.
Well, let me press you on this a little bit, because states representing societies, the governance of a society or a nation, also has some type of public interest that they want the population to behave in a certain way because it's better for the population. And I'm thinking here, let's take it away from the healthcare issue for a minute. I'm thinking about the issue of public education, that we would agree that in modern era that it's better for students to get educated. And so we, over the course of the last 100, 150 years or so, have developed the public school system. And we think that this is a good thing, that every child should go through grades K through 12 to get educated, because that'll help the population. We have an interest as a society seeing that happen. But what if there are some religious groups that want to opt out of that? They say, no, according to our religion, we don't send our kids to be educated. We're going to educate them in something else. We're going to say, skip math, skip science, etc.
Yeah. So, there's two Supreme Court cases on this very issue, and it's a really nice example, because so there's a realm of freedom, of religious freedom, where we say the state can't properly intrude. But of course, government, we have government to protect rights, to order our society toward the common good, and there are legitimate government interests that may conflict with religious precepts. So public education is certainly a legitimate government interest. The state of Oregon actually passed a law, this is early in the 20th century, saying children must attend public school. That is, it was illegal for Catholics to send their kids to Catholic schools. I don't remember the year, but this is in the 1910s or 1920s. The Supreme Court struck that down as an improper exercise of state power. You can't prohibit a parent from sending them to a religious school. The state of Wisconsin had a mandatory school attendance law. And we would say, look, that's a quintessential state interest that kids be sent to school. But the Amish, in this case, this is in 1970, a case called Wisconsin v. Yoder. And the Amish said, look, our religious tradition is to pull our kids out of school after the eighth grade. We don't send our kids to high school. You know, the Amish believe of a sort of non-technological way of life, a way of life that is fostered by especially living on farms and crafts and just a more traditional way of doing things. And they said, well, we don't need our kids to go to high school to learn that way of life, to be that way of life. In fact, it's against our religion. The Supreme Court actually said, in this case, Wisconsin v. Yoder from the 70s, that the Amish have a right to be exempt from mandatory school attendance laws. So there are certainly legitimate state interests, and there is certainly a realm of religious liberty. And what's difficult and what's confusing is when the proponents of religious liberty and the proponents of legitimate state interests overlap and conflict with one another.
Yeah, that could be very difficult. If I could bring it back to the realm of medical care, too. I know there's been recent controversies about whether all public school kids should get vaccinations or inoculations. I know there's some religious traditions that don't believe in that, Christian Scientists and maybe Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm not exactly sure on that. And that controversy often crops up because the idea here is that, well, you need all the kids, or at least the vast majority of kids, to get inoculations for this whole vaccination program to work. And you're balancing out religious liberty, okay, your tenets say you don't believe in getting injections, versus this issue of let's keep all the kids from getting polio or some other type of whooping cough or other disease.
Yeah, so this is maybe a good place to back up, and let me explain the areas of conflict and how we might disentangle them.
Yeah, it'd be helpful.
There are some things that everyone would agree the government can't do.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the government can't require that on Sunday everyone go to church. Or correspondingly, the government can't prohibit people from going to specific religions on Sunday or Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So those would be laws that directly single out a particular religion or religion in general for disfavorable treatment. Criminalizing a religious practice as a religious practice, for example, the sacramental drinking of wine, to criminalize that would clearly be unconstitutional. Everyone agrees on that. Another example, actually, from our founding history. In colonial Virginia, to be a minister, you had to get a license from the state. Kind of like to be a doctor or a public school teacher or even a beautician today, you have to get a license from the state. And the colonial Virginia said, we need to make sure we have good preaching, so you have to get a license from the state to preach, and therefore when you could preach and who could preach was regulated. And we say, look, the government can't legitimately do that. So these laws and regulations that directly target religion as such, First Amendment prohibits those. But then there's a whole other class of law that indirectly burdens religious exercises. And the examples you gave on inoculations or mandatory school attendance laws, these are not laws that target religion as such, but disproportionately impact religious believers. And what the court has done for a long time, though it's deviated from this more recently, is said, well, we'll balance the interests of the state and the interests of religious believers. And if there's not a compelling state interest, religious believers get an exemption from the law. So those are the two basic categories of laws here. So laws that directly target a religion are prohibited by the First Amendment. Laws that indirectly or disproportionately affect religious believers, burden religious believers, one understanding is that we give an exemption to religious believers on a case-by-case basis from those laws. So that's how you'd adjudicate inoculations or such. And you might say, no, in this case, there's a compelling public interest, and therefore we don't give an exemption. Now, I bring that distinction to play because what the bishops said and why I wrote the article I did, why I found this so interesting, the bishops did not say, we want an exemption from the HHS contraception mandate. Mm. And that's the usual approach. You go for an exemption. But they did not say that. They said, this law is unjust for everyone and therefore should be overturned. It's an unjust law. Right?
Right.
It's unjust for everyone. And that's a different stance than the bishops have, at least in recent memory, been taking. It's a much more, to be honest, a hard-line stance, more principled stance. They say no one should be forced to pay for someone else's contraception.
Yeah, that's a very big, important point to make as well, because one could see a number of different political strategies that the bishops could take. Say, oh, okay, here's this bill that says we have to pay for insurance that covers contraception or abortion-inducing drugs, etc. We disagree with that. May we please have an exception? And actually, there's been a number of exceptions granted to different portions of the Affordable Care Act already granted to some. And so you can say, hey, you know, Catholic Church got that, Catholic Hospital got that, University of Notre Dame got that. Great, we're finished here. But as you point out in your article, and I think this is a very important point, they took a much more expansive look at the entire issue here and said, no, it's not just Catholic hospitals and Catholic universities and the Catholic Church. It's, you know, some guy who runs, a tool making plant who's a Catholic, right? And that he doesn't want to have the guys working in his foundry who are making tools pay for their contraception or anything else as well. So is that what they're doing as well? They're concerned about not just Catholic institutions per se, but Catholics in general?
Yeah, and I would even say more than that, to religious liberty in general. I think the bishops realize that it's not enough, actually, just to get an exemption, say, for my own university, for Notre Dame. Okay, so you could see the bishops thinking, well, we don't want to try to overturn this mandate, but we need to get an exemption for Catholic hospitals and Catholic universities and Catholic churches themselves. But if they went that route, if they went the exemption route, what are they going to say to the Catholic business owner?
Right.
Or even the non-Catholic business owner or non-Catholic institution, but that also might have objections to abortifacients and contraception. And I think that, to their credit, I think, the bishops realized, you know what, the reasons why we find this morally objectionable and a burden to our conscience are not just our Catholic conscience. They're going to be a burden to all sorts of people. And we have to, now they didn't say this, this is my interpretation, we have to throw our political weight on the side of freedom, as we understand it, and protect the freedom of all Catholic institutions, non-Catholic institutions, Catholic business owners, non-Catholic business owners. This is why it's so important, I think they say, the law must be repealed. It's an unjust law in and of itself. Now, we could have a conversation, is it really an unjust law or not? But that's the bishops have taken very much a principled stand on behalf of everyone. It's a pretty bold stand. I mean, the bishops are usually pretty moderate in their politics, and they don't try to get too far out in front of issues, but they're really taking a principled stand here.
Now, I want to clarify something, because we talk about this law is unjust. Are we talking about the entire Affordable Care Act, or are we just talking about that specific portion requiring that insurance companies provide contraception?
Just the contraception mandate,
okay.
Not the whole thing. In fact, the bishops, the Catholic Church, for nearly 100 years has been a proponent of more generous state-subsidized health care. So the bishops are certainly not against universal health care or government-sponsored health care in general, but they are against the contraception mandate.
And see, I want to push that issue a little bit further because, when it comes to contraception, that hits on Catholic turf right there. But what about the bigger issue of the government requiring everybody to buy insurance to begin with? I mean, might there not be some business owners, some other religious traditions or something that say, no, we don't want to have anything to do with that either, and that conflicts with our general either theological principles or even ideological principles? Wasn't there any concern about the more general issue of the government requiring insurance to be purchased?
Yeah, I think, here's where the bishops tend to pronounce more general principles. The bishops think it's very good, and this is just a common sense principle, it's very good for individuals to have health care. We want people to have health care. The bishops have actually said there's a right to health care. I personally don't agree with that, but that's what the bishops have said. How you carry that out is a matter that they say is beyond our competence, but we're in favor of health care and we're in favor of universal health care. I think some bishops are starting to realize that maybe a government-run system is not the best system, because if you have a government-run system, the government is going to define what health is.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't seem very controversial, but think about it. Is contraception a part of health? Is not getting pregnant actually part of health?
Yeah.
And that's an interesting question. I think unreasonable people can disagree. And if we keep these matters private, then we can, by private I mean not through the government, it's easier to agree to disagree. But if it's going to be a government-run system, the government's going to have to decide, is contraception health? And I think the bishops are starting to realize, or maybe some of the bishops are starting to realize, that increase of government power can be very dangerous to the church and to private associations and other competing institutions. It crowds out the private sphere. Now you're going to make every hospital have a uniform definition of health vis-a-vis contraception. Well, how can you have Catholic hospitals in that environment.
Yeah, it gets to this bigger issue of really defining what is in the public interest. We were talking about education policy a while ago, and I had made the statement, well, we can all agree that having kids educated from K to 12 is a really good thing. But actually, some people might not say that. You know, the Amish said, no, we, you know, our kids up through eighth grade is fine, but after that, we're going to bring them, you know, to our homestead, and we're going to teach them carpentry skills. And boy, that's really valuable, and they live fulfilled lives. And isn't that in the public interest as well?
Yeah, and you know, in the so I should clarify. Back in the 70s in Wisconsin, at least, there was no homeschooling laws.
Right,
you couldn't do that. Every kid had to go to school, and a much more sensible policy is to allow a homeschooling option. Right, this is how you accommodate everyone in the law, not a special exemption for religious believers, but you know, there's lots of people who want to homeschool, not just religious people. And you know, so what the I think what the bishops here are calling for, look, we need a better law. This is a bad law. We shouldn't force. We should be very clear here. We're talking about forcing some individuals, that is, employers, to pay for the contraception of other individuals. We're not talking about the government buying the contraception.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about making private individual A pay for the contraception of private individual B. And I think the church's bishops are saying that's too far. We're intruding too much into the private sphere, at least on contraception.
Well, this discussion brings me to a more general philosophical point about Catholic views on governance that I've been interested in for a long time. I've, you know, studied the Catholic Church in Latin America and other places, as well as Protestants. And you know, I've run across this theoretical debate about Catholic views on governance here. So I want to talk a little bit about that. I know within the realm of Catholic social and political thinking, there's something known as the principle of subsidiarity. And if I'm correct, the idea there is that social problems should be handled at the lowest level possible. An idea that seems to go along great with the Federalist traditions of the United States dating back to the founding documents. However, you know, as you had mentioned, the Catholic bishops have often been very much in favor of providing national health care or even critiquing more free market laissez-faire approaches to things. And this has been true of the popes for the past century, including John Paul II and even Benedict XVI. Many theologically conservative bishops are, you know, thought to be, well, they're economically theologically conservative. They're not. They often seem to harbor serious doubts about free market capitalism and devolving economic decisions to the lowest level. And they often tend to prefer more corporatist forms of economic government where the government acts as a coordinating hand. Am I reading this tension correctly within Catholic intellectual circles? And
I think that's a really nice summary, actually, that traditionally being especially the last 100 years, the Catholic hierarchy, especially in Europe, I mean, you know, the Pope is in Europe, has been, it's sort of on the left of the political spectrum, and it would be way too far to say the Catholic Church has a socialistic strain. I mean, John Paul II was very much against socialism,
mm-hmm.
but in general, what we call big government liberalism or the social safety net, government providing basic necessities, including healthcare, that the Catholic Church has, as an institution, has pretty much been in favor of those types of policies. They certainly have not been on the libertarian or free market strain of our political divide.
But how does that square with that issue of subsidiarity? Am I construing or characterizing the issue of subsidiarity correctly?
I think you are. Yeah. And they're not easily compatible. I don't know that they're necessarily opposed. So let me say a little bit about what I think the Catholic Church's position, and then I'd actually be more comfortable just speaking on my own terms. I mean, I think the Catholic Church looks at politics in a prudential manner. So it's good for everyone to have health care. How that's done, how you deliver health care, whether it's from a free market system or a single-payer system, the church has no expertise in that, right? But it is in favor of health care for everyone. There has been certainly a tendency to a friendliness to the state providing services. I think you are starting to see in some Catholic thinkers a rethinking of the embrace of the state as the best vehicle by which to provide social services. So let me just give you an example, something I don't know much about, but it's easy to think about. Catholic hospitals. So, I mean, this Catholic hospitals are a perfect example of the church working out its mission in the world. I mean, Catholic hospitals serve the poor. So, I mean, they don't just serve the poor, but they do serve the poor. And throughout the 20th century, since the Catholic Church had its hospitals in place, when there was an expansion of government and government funds were made available to the church to help it run its hospitals, I think the church rightly thought, look, if we have government funding of our hospitals, at least to some degree, we can serve more people. And so they embraced sort of welfare state liberalism as a way for the Catholic Church to help do its mission of being servants to the poor and less fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
But now I think what some people in the church are realizing, well, those government dollars come with a certain government ideology, an ideology about, in this particular case, healthcare. And in fact, government regulation, that makes it very hard for the church to do its mission. Another example, Catholic adoption services. So the Catholic Church does great work in helping adoption. I mean, this is part of its championing the position of life. You know, the Catholic Church clearly is against abortion. Well, some women are willing to bear a child, but they can't raise a child. Well, that's where the church steps in and says, well, we'll provide adoption services. But the Catholic Church in, for example, the state of Massachusetts and the city of Boston won't let the Catholic Church do adoptions because the Catholic Church says we can't do gay adoptions. We can't facilitate adoptions by homosexuals.
Mm-hmm.
Just another example where the church traditionally has been an ally of the state, but now the state is crowding out the Catholic position in these matters. Well, examples like this, to finally get around to answering your question, I think are making some Catholics rethink its embracing of social welfare policies, very big government policies, because big government is really encroaching on the ability of the church to do its own policies, and correspondingly reinvigorating this idea of subsidiarity, which you had exactly right. Subsidiarity is the idea that it's better for problems to be solved on the most local level possible. So a family dispute, it's better to solve it within the family, not the court system, for example. Education, better that local communities do education. Now, you can't do everything at the local level. You know, national defense has to be done at the national level.
Right.
But in general, a preference should be for local communities because that allows people to control their lives. And it's part of the idea of human freedom and self-government that the Catholic Church very much does champion.
Let me ask you this, that if the abortion issue never came up or the contraception issue never came up, would this have spurred the Catholic bishops into saying anything about the healthcare law? I mean, that's a little bit of a counterfactual theorizing, but hey, what the heck? Let's talk about it.
Well, I think to link this with my past comment, I think, look, the Catholic Church is not on the side of the sexual revolution. And pretty much all the conflicts we're having with the healthcare, Obamacare, and the Catholic Church deal in one way or another with the sexual revolution, with abortion and contraception. And yeah, this is why the Catholic Church, I think, or some Catholics are thinking, hey, big government is a problem because big government embraces the sexual revolution and therefore defines health as including contraception. And it's very hard for us, I'm speaking of the bishops now, to partner with groups and ways and with government in ways which it fosters a moral teaching we disagree with.
Yeah. You talk about, and I think you're correct, a lot of the controversy that has come up with this healthcare bill recently, specifically with Catholics, has been on these issues of sexual revolution type of things, contraception, abortion, and the like. I'm taking it back to the politics of 2009, 2010, I remember there was a group of Catholic legislators, most of them were Democrats, who really were the swing votes on the passage of this bill. I think it was headed by Michigan Representative Bart Stupak, and it was a group of 8, 9, 10, or 12 different Catholic Democrats. And were the bishops involved in any way at any point in time during that whole debating process saying, whoa, 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 this could be a problem here in terms of abortion or contraception. You guys got to get some guarantees here. Were they involved in that?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. What I can say is I think Catholic leadership, especially the leadership that that came out in favor, in general, of the healthcare law, or at least didn't stand opposed to it, believed that these issues, for example, the contraception issues, would not be forced upon Catholic individuals and Catholic institutions. And that, I think, and this is why I said the September 2010, I mean, the church bishops were saying, hey, we're not against healthcare, but it can't be done in a way that forces us to pay for abortifacients or contraception. And I think, it comes back to Obama being invited out here to Notre Dame. I think that was an olive branch from a Catholic institution to say, hey, we'll support, you know, we won't stand opposed to you, we'll support you, but you got to be respectful of our positions and especially our conscientious exemption positions. And I think a lot of, especially Catholics on the left, have felt betrayed by the Obama administration.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Do you think that the bishops and other Catholic intellectuals felt a little bit stung by the decision? And it seemed just to come out of the blue about 3, 4, 5 months ago or so?
Yeah, and you know what's shocking? I don't know if you've seen this video, but Secretary Sebelius, she's the head of the HHS, was just testifying in Congress a few days ago, and there's a representative from South Carolina, Representative Gowdy, questioning her, and basically asking her, did you think about religious liberty? Do you know the law, the First Amendment law on religious liberty? Do you know these cases? He asked her about the Yoder case, the Amish case, and her response was shocking. She's like, no, I don't know about these cases. No, I don't know how the law turned out. No, I don't know what the First Amendment requires. And, I think Secretary Sebelius, this is just not a big issue for her. I mean, I think for her, contraception is just a part of health, and it's not an issue. I don't even think she saw it as a religious liberty issue, and therefore didn't pay attention to it. You know, in good faith, I mean, I think for her, this is a non-issue.
Yeah.
And, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I was thinking as you're saying that, you know, once the government gets so big and, you know, you have Sebelius who is working in the Department of the Health and Human Services, that's her thing that she deals with. She doesn't have to deal with religion stuff. That never comes up, right? That's for a different department or that's for somebody else. And so one can see as the government becomes bigger and bigger, everything becomes more compartmentalized. You lose the holistic approach to what is actually going on here. And I wouldn't be surprised to see more of these conflicts occurring.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, boy, this might be a little bit controversial, but the best argument, I'm going to bring in homosexual marriage here. The best argument I think that was made for homosexual marriage was, a marriage between two men does not affect heterosexual marriage if it's a pro-marriage position. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very compelling argument in terms of advertising and gaining support for gay marriage. But that's not the whole story, actually, because what the gay marriage argument does is it says, as a matter of law and public policy, you cannot connect the sexual relations to procreation. And, gay marriage is not a big issue for me. I don't have particularly strong feelings one way or another. But the idea that it's illegitimate to connect sex to procreation leads to Secretary Sebelius thinking, this is just a health issue, right? I mean, there is a connection here, right? And, I mean, that's a larger question, but this is the way the culture is going, and as the culture goes this way, well, the government is going to go this way.
Yeah.
And I think the Catholic bishops are realizing that, and that these types of public policies that force Catholic institutions to go against their conscience are going, I mean, this is going to happen more and more and more. This is just the very beginning.
Yeah, no, I can see how that's going to be the case. Let me go ahead and bring it back to the bishops' statement once again. And we had just talked about how, you know, the bishops felt a little bit betrayed or stung by the fact that this contraception issue just came out of the blue recently. So they go ahead and they write this letter. How did the Obama administration react to the bishops' statement that, hey, this is not a good thing, back off this?
You know, I don't know that they have, actually. You know, I don't. It hasn't created that much of a public stir, as far as I know. The Obama administration has said, look, we'll wait a year before we implement this law, so the contraception mandate doesn't go into effect for another year after the election. I don't know if the Obama administration is going to budge on this. I don't think the administration is going to budge, and I don't know what the church will do in response. I just don't know how this is going to play out. I mean, it's shocking to me. I thought what was going to happen is there'd be a more expansive accommodation, and Notre Dame would get an exception from the contraception mandate, and you know, some Catholic hospitals would get an exception, but the Catholic business owner would not. The Obama administration didn't want to go that way, and now the Catholic bishops have said we don't want an accommodation. So I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Wasn't initially there some sort of compromised offer, and that the bishops were rather dissatisfied with it? I think if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong on this, the Obama administration came back and says, "Oh, don't worry, the Catholic Church doesn't have to provide the insurance for the contraception. It's the insurance agency that you're hiring that has to."
That's right. That was the proposal. I think the bishops, I think, saw that something as an accounting trick, because presumably the insurance company is just going to charge more to the Catholic institution. But you know, it wasn't actually a very thoughtful proposal, because there's all sorts of institutions. For example, Notre Dame self-insures.
Mm-hmm.
So the Obama alleged compromise was we'll just kick the insurance costs for contraception to the insurance company. But there is no insurance company to kick those costs to in the case of Notre Dame. They self-insure.
Yeah, either that, or they'd have to stop self-insuring and go to.
They'd have to stop self-insuring, which would amount to a huge penalty, a financial penalty. Mm-hmm. So, that compromise just wasn't. It wasn't much of a compromise, and I don't know the extensive details, but I think a lot of Catholic leaders thought it was more of an accounting trick than a real genuine compromise.
Have you heard anything about Catholic lawmakers thinking in the House of Representatives, or perhaps some senators, that have reacted to the bishop's statements, that they've said, hadn't thought of this, and bishops, wow, you have something to say on that?
Yeah, I think so, actually. And, you know, when you started the show with Pelosi's comment, you know, we have to pass this thing to see what's in it. And I think people are starting to realize, hey, that's not a good way to make laws.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and there were a few congressmen who said, well, if we knew this was going to be in the law, we wouldn't have passed it. And, you know, ultimately elections matter. So what happens in November will matter. I mean, if Mitt Romney wins, well, first of all, we have the Supreme Court case. I mean, the Supreme Court could get rid of this issue altogether.
Mm-hmm.
If they strike down the insurance mandate and they strike the whole policy down. And if the Supreme Court upholds it, this whole issue could be moot if Mitt Romney wins. But if the Supreme Court doesn't uphold the law, and if Obama wins re-election, we're going to have a real showdown, I think. I don't see where the compromise. Now, you know, maybe calmer heads will prevail. Maybe we'll find some sort of compromise. But I don't know what that compromise is going to be.
Now, we're recording this in early May of 2012, and I think most people are aware that this is a presidential election season, which you just alluded to. Looks like it's going to be Barack Obama versus Mitt Romney in the presidential election. We have a Supreme Court case coming up here. Have you kept your finger on the pulse of Catholic public opinion on this issue at all?
You know, I have to confess, not more than probably the average citizen.
Okay. Well, I mean, you're in Catholic circles. You're Notre Dame. There's a lot of Catholics there, I hear. Is this controversy stirring up some Catholic voters? Is this something that they're talking about now, or is this something that's just sliding under the radar screen as another issue within a panoply of issues that are swirling around them?
Well, I think more the latter, more that it's just one other issue. But, you know, I have two things to say this. One thing is the bishops called for what they called a fortnight of freedom, the 2 weeks before the 4th of July, for local dioceses and churches, Catholic institutions, to have teachings about religious liberty. And I think part of that call was to inform us about our freedoms, but also, you know, they want to inform us for our freedoms to make people realize that this is really going to be quite, Obamacare in its current form is quite oppressive on this one particular contraception mandate. So this issue could become more salient as the election season gets closer, and I think the bishops are trying to make it more salient, not necessarily in an anti-Obama way. I don't mean to be construed against that. I think what they would really like is just a more extensive accommodation or a repeal of the law, or this repeal of the contraception mandate. I mean, I think many, many Catholics would be happy if Obama just took a step back on the contraception mandate.
Mm-hmm.
So it could become more salient. The second thing to mention is, I think when I wrote the Weekly Standard article, I had about 100 emails that came in within 24 hours, and one thing kept on coming over and over in some of the emails, which was people writing, I'm not Catholic, but I stand with the bishops on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think anyone should be forced to pay for the contraception for someone else. And I was really surprised to get that comment. I got it over and over and over. One person said, you know, if anything should be private, this should be private. And the email went on to say, you know, I don't like the idea of a boss saying what his employee should be able to do regarding with contraception. And therefore, we should actually disaggregate insurance from work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, no one's talking about that right now. But I think you're going to start hearing more and more sentiments like that. You know, why should we have... I agree with that. I think contraception should be a private matter.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's boss should be able to dictate what their employees use or don't use for contraception. But therefore, I think bosses shouldn't be paying for contraception. And I think that, I don't know, I think that's a common sense sentiment that's not reflected in our politics that may get more and more reflected in our politics.
Yeah, just on an economic side there too, I've always been curious in why, you know, our employers give us health care insurance and they don't buy our auto insurance. There's reasons for that.
You know the history of that, don't you?
Say what?
You know the history of that.
Well, it goes back to high tax rates back in the 1940s, 1950s.
And wage controls.
Exactly.
In that the government said you can't raise employees' wages, but you can give them health insurance as a compensation, right? I mean, this is me speaking here, certainly not speaking on behalf of the Church or the bishops, but this is a product of government regulation of economic activity.
No, I talked to my...
It's not at all clear to me that it's wise for our health insurance to be done through employment. I think it introduces all sorts of pathologies and limits freedom in all sorts of ways that are undesirable.
No, I talked to many of my political economy students about this when we get into these debates, and we go back to the 1950s where one of the top marginal rates on income over $200,000 was, you know, in the upper 80s, low 90s. And so that means every dollar that you earned above $200,000 that, you know, you get to keep 6 cents of it. And, you know, a lot of people says, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to work any harder after that rate. And so companies said, well, can we provide health care insurance? Can we start buying things? Other things were, you know, examples were company cars. They would give I remember in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, people would have company cars all the time for the executives.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of result. And when students make those connections, they say, oh, you know, government policies have a lot of interesting unintended consequences, don't they?
Said,
yeah.
I mean, it's sort of amazing that our politics, we're arguing about birth control. I mean, if anything should be private, birth control should be private. And I would just, this is me personally. You know, I would like to get these questions out of politics. And I'm all for individual responsibility, and if people are mature enough to be engaging in sexual relations, they're hopefully mature enough to go out and get their own birth control. I mean, I actually think that's a common sense sentiment.
Yeah.
I suppose I'm in the minority there, but that's where I'd like to see our politics go.
I don't know. It's getting back to that subsidiarity issue again, and, you know, devolving more decision-making power to the lowest level possible where it's can best be made. There's a couple questions that were prompted by our earlier discussion here. You were talking about how you were getting emails from people who said, well, I'm not Catholic, but wow, I really like the Catholic bishop statement. And that prompted two questions in my head. First of all, have there been any other religious groups that have gotten on the Catholic Church bandwagon about this issue of contraception, or has this only been a Catholic Church thing? Have they been the ones that are the only ones making the clarion call?
Yeah, no, I don't know. The groups would say they're getting on the Catholic Church bandwagon, but there certainly have been Protestants and Jewish groups that I know of that have expressed similar concerns and reservations about the contraception mandate. The Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations, a Jewish group, made very similar arguments. This was back in January, about how defining contraception in terms of required health and preventive services is against their moral stance and moral position.
Mm-hmm.
And a Baptist group, the Southern Baptist Committee for Religious Freedom, came out with a statement, again, making basically the same argument. I think it's the name is the Southern Baptist Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, came out with a statement and is either in January or February, saying that the Obama mandate is not just a Catholic issue, the contraception mandate is not just a Catholic issue, this is an issue of religious freedom for us too.
The other question that this raised when you're talking about your emails, you said, oh, I'm not Catholic, but boy, the bishops have really influenced my opinion on this, or I stand with it. Here's the other more general question about religion and politics is, how much influence do you think a statement like what the bishops just released has on the Catholic voter? Are Catholics tuned into this? They say, whoa, my bishop just said this is a bad policy. Maybe I better rethink the way I'm voting, and maybe I better get involved in the upcoming campaign.
Yeah, I don't think bishops have that much influence now, for good or for bad, maybe for both. I think when bishops are preaching about the issue in the pulpits, that will lead people to take another look at the issue, or maybe pay attention to the issue. And if the bishops can frame this as an issue of religious liberty, not as an issue of simply about contraception, I think that will resonate with people. I actually think most Americans believe that individual A should not be forced to pay for individual B's contraception and abortifacients. I actually think that's a common sense position. And if that position gets out, and it's not so much that because the bishop said it, that people, Catholics or otherwise, will vote, but because the bishops are saying something that resonates with common sense and the common good for those individuals. And so I think the bishops can certainly motivate some Catholics who simply because they're bishops, but I think more generally the bishops, if they can bring attention to the issue, make people think about the issue, and people do think about the issue, they might say, oh yeah, the bishops are on to something, not because they're necessarily bishops, because that makes sense to me. That makes sense in terms of common good and justice, and we shouldn't make individuals pay for other individuals' contraception. So, you know, we'll see. This election will be telling. And
mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to watch that fortnight of freedom that the bishops announced. I hadn't heard anything about that. And so I think, oh, my gosh, that'll be something interesting to see if that prompts people into action or not. Or, you know, even depending on when the Supreme Court case is decided, which is probably going to be late June, mid to late June.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I think this issue and this bishop statement maybe has not got a lot of attention or even a response from Obama, because people are going to wait and see, well, what happens with that Supreme Court decision on the Commerce Clause and the insurance mandate, and if it's held up, and when the election season comes around, especially in September and October, no doubt Mitt Romney's going to make this an issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think then if it might get a lot more attention and a lot more salience with Catholic voters, but with other voters too.
Yeah, I would guess that if the Supreme Court strikes down the entire Obamacare law, the fortnight of freedom might seem like it becomes moot. But one of the other things that I noticed when I was reading the bishop's letter was that this just wasn't about the healthcare mandate. And so the fortnight of freedom is not just about religious freedom and healthcare and contraception, but the bishops went through that letter and mentioned several other points that they felt religious liberty, religious conscience was being threatened by a variety of government policies, not only at the federal level, but at the state level. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. They explicitly mention the Alabama state's immigration law,
mm-hmm.
and they say, now, I don't know much about Alabama state immigration law here, but the recent law passed in Alabama, according to the local bishop, would make it illegal for Catholic individuals to pick up an illegal immigrant and drive them to church. It would make it illegal for a Catholic priest to hear the confession of an illegal immigrant. And so they pointed out, they being the local bishop and the bishops more generally in the statement of religious freedom, how these governmental policies in Alabama are encroaching on religious freedom. And so, yeah, the main focus of the letter, I think, actually is the contraception mandate, but there's certainly other issues out there, too, in this Alabama immigration issue. And this is a good example, actually, how the bishop in that diocese have called attention to this issue, and I've read just today that the Alabama state legislature is going to try to clarify their law or rescind part of the law to make sure that priests are not getting in trouble for hearing confessions and breaking the law.
A mm-hmm.
Good example of how the call to conscience of a religious leader can help spark political change. I mean, it's a good example, too. I didn't know anything about this, but because the bishops were writing about this, I went out, you know, I looked up the law and saw that it was problematic, and I'm sure that that's happening in Alabama in particular.
Yeah, and it gets back to your issue of the Catholic bishops when they get involved in the political arena are rather prudential in this. I think a lot of people will look at this letter, they will zero in on the contraception issue, the healthcare issue, and say, oh, the bishops are coming out being really anti-Obama. But on the other hand, in terms of the immigration issue, they're really taking a position that favors what the Obama Justice Department has been talking about in the past couple of years. So again, very prudential approach to issue-by-issue matters.
Yeah, and to be honest, I think the bishops are trying to find a way to uphold the healthcare, Obamacare more generally. I think the bishops in general are, they haven't completely stated a position on it, but they're not opposed to Obamacare in general. They're just opposed to this one particular aspect of Obamacare, relatively small part of it. And if anything, they're trying to say, hey, this is a way we can support the larger project. And, you know, this is one objectionable provision. Sort of what's surprising to me is I just don't know why the president hasn't said, you know, this, we don't need this fight. Let's yeah. not, you know, it's not worth it to mobilize all these Catholic voters against Obamacare. I mean, let's give them a bigger exemption. Yeah. I'm surprised Obama, and maybe it's not Obama, maybe it's Secretary Sebelius, but I'm surprised they picked this fight.
It might be, as you said, everybody's in a holding pattern to see what the Supreme Court does. And, you know, the Obama administration is making a political calculation saying, hey, by pressing this fight, we're organizing or rallying our secular base that considers this to be a rather important issue. And, hey, if it gets struck down, we just blame the Supreme Court. And if it doesn't get struck down, well, you know, maybe in July or August we'll deal with exceptions when it comes then.
I think you're probably right. I think there will be a large, if the law is not struck down in general, there'll be a larger exception offered. But, you know, we'll see. And maybe, you know, maybe President Obama in particular, you know, I don't know that this was on his radar screen so much, and it just could be his cabinet officials, and they didn't realize how problematic this would be for the Catholic bishops. And, you know, maybe this is just a painful way to find the common ground.
Well, as we come to the end of our podcast here, I do want to refer people to look at the Bishop's Conference letter, and we'll link to it up on our website because, again, you know, it does talk a lot about contraception and healthcare issues as we've been talking about here. But, again, the immigration issue has been mentioned. There's been, you know, discussion in there about New York City's attempt to prohibit religious groups from renting space in public schools and other public buildings. And so it's a very rich document, I think, and I think one would be really wise to go ahead and check out that document if you're interested in these kind of issues. They also close it with, I think, a very salient prayer too. Is that correct?
That's right.
I was wondering if you have that in front of you, could you read that for?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. Let me see if I can find it here. Yeah, it's quite a moving prayer, actually.
It is. When I read it, it was, you know, there's a policy wonk aspect to all this kind of stuff, but then it closes, and I think in a very spiritual, uplifting kind of way.
Okay, well, here it is. I'll read it for you. Almighty God, Father of all nations, for freedom you have set us free and in Christ Jesus. We praise and bless you for the gift of religious liberty, the foundation of human rights, justice, and the common good. Grant to our leaders the wisdom to protect and promote our liberties. By your grace, may we have the courage to defend them for ourselves and for all those who live in this blessed land. We ask through the intercession of Mary Immaculate, our patroness, and in the name of your Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, in the unity of the Holy Spirit, with whom you live and reign, one God, forever and ever. Amen.
Well, that is a very great way to close this issue about religious liberty and how it intersects with a number of different issues on public policy. So, Philip, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion here.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.